It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to Jill on Money. It is Academy Award weekend. I heard a crazy stat about the number of tickets, movie tickets, that a household buys in a given year. It's not zero, but it's something like four, and it used to be 30. And that's insane. I could be totally misquoting that, but I think that's right. So here's what I did. I just went on to Oscar.go.com to find out a little bit about the Oscars. And, you know, it is true. I used to go to the movies and try to see everything that was nominated. And here's what I've seen. I'm looking here. You know what I've seen, Mark? One Best Picture. And remember, there's a lot of them now. One, two, three, four, five, six, ten. Oh, my God. I only saw La La Land. Mark, do you still get screeners, if you will? Where are they? Because you're in the union? Is that how come? Mark, the best producer in the world. One of the reasons I keep him around is that he'll often, you know, say to me, well, see this movie around the award season. And how does he see all these? Because do you get to vote or you just get to see them? He can vote. Are you going to vote this year? You haven't seen anything. You haven't seen enough. Anyway, I'm just going to say that it's just really amazing. Oh, Meryl Streep got nominated. So if she wins, we can only expect the president's going to tweet about this. Maybe they'll stop. That's enough, right? All right. Well, I don't have a... Here's a second movie I saw. Zootopia. Loved it. Animated. It was so great. I don't have a lot to tell you, gang. Go see some movies. It's good for the industry. Think about this. How much does a movie ticket cost in New York City, Mark? $14-15. Maybe in the burbs, it's like $10. So if you got a family of four, that is serious moolah. As opposed to, let's all watch a little Netflix, even though I know Netflix is, you know, but think about when you think of it that way, the value of Netflix is huge. Huge. All right. I want both of those movies that you just put down there. He's texting me. Okay, let's get to you. Tell me what your favorite movies are. Let's start with a call. It's Rod, who's on the line from Georgia. Rod, have you seen a lot of the Academy Award nominated movies for this year?
I'm sorry, I have not.
Have you seen any?
No, I've seen some that I thought should be nominated, like Sully.
Oh, that dude is awesome. Mark's giving you a big thumbs up. You know, I met him once in CBS. I was a little fangirl. I chased him down the hall and shook his hand. It was fun. What's going on with you? How can I help you today, Rod?
68 years old, retired, trying to decide whether to pay off my house or not.
And, okay.
You know, I could tell you all the details, or you can just ask me. But
give me some details. Are you married?
Yes, I'm married. My wife is retired also.
Uh-huh.
Our house is, the mortgage is $108,900.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth about $300,000. Got a 3.25 interest rate.
3.25. Oh, brother, that is pretty fab. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
And did you refinance that within the last few years?
I did with the VA.
Okay. Oh, great. All right. Okay. So you guys are both retired. Are you living on your investments or your pension and Social Security? What combination?
That's the good news. We are not living on any of our savings, just our pensions and Social Security.
And that completely covers your needs, right?
It does.
Okay. Do you have other investments like 401k or 403b or IRAs, stuff that you had used for, did you have like a little nest egg?
Well, let me tell you what I got. My wife has $9,000 in a 401. We have $43,000 in a retirement mutual fund, and we got $171,000 in savings.
Just a plain old savings account?
Just a plain old savings account. Uh-huh. And I'm so tempted. I was going to invest that money in several different things, mostly in a stock and bond index funds. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could pay off the house and have about $100,000, but there was something that happened. We had some very serious, like a lot of people, health problems earlier in 2000, which really took down most of our savings and ran up some debt. We've got all that paid off, and we've got our savings back to what I just told you. So it just scares me a little bit. But if something happened to me, even if I paid off the house, I don't think my wife would stay here more than a year, so she could sell the house and then have that money. If something happens to me, my wife is going to have about $4,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking about with that money in savings, you know, she could draw out an extra $1,000 or $1,200 a month or something like that. So it's just whether to invest it, whether to pay off the house. That's my question.
Okay. First of all, it's a great question. It sounds like you guys have done a very good job. I'm sorry you had a health issue. That can really sap a lot of your retirement savings. I think people actually very much underestimate that. So I'm sorry you had to go through it yourselves. Now, the one thing about the calculation about paying off your house, in my mind, goes something like this. On one hand, you say, I've got all this money in savings, and it's getting bupkis in interest, right? Because interest rates are really low. So why not take, you know, $108,900 out of savings, pay off the note? I've got then, essentially, it's as if I'm making 3.25% on that money. And so be it. That sounds like a great... So as a straight-up calculation, that makes sense. Here's your big but. The big but is that, number one, you do have a very low interest rate. And I presume that, essentially, even though the savings account is pretty fat right now, your intention wouldn't be to just, you know, receive a quarter of 1% or a half of 1% for the rest of your hopefully many years as investors. So, you know, could you earn more than 3.25% over the longer term with that money? That is one question to consider. And when we come back from the break, I am going to actually give you another big question to consider, because it's a very important concept for every single retiree. So hang on the line, Rod, and everybody here who's thinking about retirement, considering retirement, pay attention, because I'm about to give you a golden rule of retirement savings. How about that? It's Jill on Money. Hey, you know what? Money's not scary. It's not boring. It can be a little bit of fun. We're really going to have some fun with it. 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Annuities, IRAs, 401ks, she covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. By the way, I'm sitting here in the studio and the phone rings. It's my mother, right? And so I don't answer it, but I send her a text during the break. I said, is everything okay? This is what you got to love a mother. Yes, but call. But she writes B-U-T-T, but call. And I was like, wait, do you mean yes, but call? Or yes, I just did a butt call. She says, I've dialed you by mistake. That's what she said. So I didn't know what she meant. Anyway, I thought that was funny. All right. You ready for your golden rule of retirement? Rod from Georgia. If you're just joining us, Rod is 68. He's retired. He's married. He and his wife live on their pension and Social Security income. Everything's really good. And he's got some money, let's say about 50 grand in retirement savings, but then another 170,000 bucks that's in a straight up savings account. And so the question is, do I pay off my $109,000 mortgage, right? And so you heard me give you the calculation, like almost the financial consideration, Rod, is, hey, you know, can I earn more than 3.25% over the next some bunch of years? And, you know, you probably can. But, you know, I think there's a bigger issue for you guys. And that is, when you pay off a mortgage, do you know what happens? You take a liquid asset and you convert it into an illiquid asset. And you mentioned, and this really, you know, struck me, and you said, hey, I had to plow through a lot of my retirement savings because of an illness. Imagine if that money were tied up in your house. And then also imagine that maybe the value of your house has gone down for some reason. And
that's
also
why I haven't done it.
Right. And so while the instinct might be, oh my God, I just want to get this paid off, a lot of people have that feeling. I say, don't do it. I think you are far better off saying, let's keep some of that money in savings, okay? You know, some amount of money that makes you guys feel comfortable. I don't know what that is for you. Is it 30 grand? Or, you know, some amount that's just safe. And for the rest of the money, I don't think it's a big problem for you to say, be in, you know, an index fund, you know, 50% stock, 50% bond or something like that. I think that's just fine. And in that way, what you're doing is you're preserving your liquidity, you're getting a little upside, and as you said, you don't have to dip into this account for a while. You could if you wanted to and you needed to, but you don't have to. So I like the idea of putting it some of it to work, leaving the mortgage alone, and as you said, if something, God forbid, were to happen to you, the other part of this is that your wife would probably move, in which case paying off the mortgage really doesn't make a lot of sense. Doesn't make it, you know, you don't have to worry about that. She'll sell the house and get the equity. So I think your original plan is actually a good plan. Just don't dive too hard into the risky stuff. Can you do that?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert. I would say I'm an intermediate financial wizard kind of thing.
But okay.
Really, at my age, and you know, I know you're going to say it depends on how many years you got. You know, I'm just counting max of about 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of has stopped me from the stock market more than anything. But it is the bond, stock index fund that I am seriously considering, besides
good,
the retirement mutual fund that I'm already in.
Okay. And are you going to do it yourself, or do you have some broker that's going to do it for you?
Well, I was going to do it myself.
Good. Perfect. That's what I was going to encourage you to do. I was going to give you a big thumbs up on that. So yeah, I think that's good. I think that for you, this is your feeling is the right feeling, and keep the expenses low. Hang on to that mortgage, and just make sure, talk to your wife also, because she may have a feeling of like, you know, honey, I'd like to keep a little bit more in savings. You know what I mean? So just have the conversation between the two of you, just so you're on the same page. And are you thinking like a 50-50 stock versus bond allocation?
That's what I was thinking, because I mean, I can have a little bit of risk.
Yeah, that's fine. And again, you're probably not going to touch the money. You're going to have to start pulling money out of retirement accounts when you're 70 and a half. That's just a small amount. But I think that makes perfect sense. So go forth and multiply your dollars and hang on to that beautiful 3.25% mortgage. How many years left on that mortgage?
Oh, good gracious. Probably 27. I just did the 30 in case I decide to pay it off sometime. But, you know, when I tell people my house payment is $491 a month, their mouth drops open.
Well, that's right. You know, and by the way, you still have income. And so you actually can claim that interest deduction against your income. People have pensions. You know, there's still tax liability. So I think you're in great shape. So I wish you the very best of luck, Rod, and thank you so much for giving us a call today.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the advice, and that's what I'm going to take. Thank
Super.
You very much.
Take care. Oh, very good. What do I got here, Mark, time-wise? Can I read? Oh, good. Okay. So I thanks for Rod for calling. If you've got a question, give us a holler, 855-411-JILL. Got an email, which, you know what? I got to love the feedback sometimes. I ask for it. So, you know, shame on me. If you're going to ask for it, you're going to have to take it. This guy, Nick, wrote me about my fiduciary article, and he's sort of wagging his finger, and he's like, you know, the people who pledge to act as a fiduciary might be able to provide access to other clients. Those legally required to act as fiduciaries are not allowed to provide any form of referrals or testimonials. Okay, but I believe you're wrong, Nick, because if you ask the permission of a client and say, will you talk to this client who will not ask you about the particulars of your situation, but would be willing to, for you to talk to them about the process, I believe that is perfectly legitimate and legal and okay. So that's number one. And then he says, would anyone refer a dissatisfied client? No, but you know what? I think you'd be surprised what people say on the phone to a stranger, like, hey, you know what? This is good, or this is what you can do. And they tend to... I think that most people will tell the truth when asked. So that's me. So then he says, also to suggest that someone else's plan could be considered similar to your needs is like asking a doctor to prescribe the same medication for you as someone who has a similar disorder. No, that is not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is this. If I want to go to a doctor, I want to say, oh, you know what? I want to go to a cardiologist. And I have a heart condition. And I asked my friend, what's the name of your cardiologist? What's your heart condition? Is it something that's similar to mine? I'm not asking for the same prescription. Am I getting like a little bit defensive? I am, because this is like, I felt like this was a little bit of an angry email. So you can ask someone about their experience with an organization. You can ask somebody what to expect. How are you contacted? All those things. Of course, what's right for one person doesn't necessarily fit you. And of course, everybody's situation is different. But for example, I could tell you this. My dad's cardiologist was amazing. He was an academic. His office is a disaster. So when I've referred people to him, I've said he is a genius. His office is a disaster. There's never anybody at the desk. It is terrible patient outreach. And if you go in there expecting that you need like an academic dude to help you with your heart condition, this is the guy. But his office stinks. And I have done that. I swear to you, I have made that exact recommendation. And I think that what you're seeking when you're talking to people about their experience with an advisor, with a physician, with a lawyer, is not full disclosure of their situation, but what can I expect? What's your experience with this organization, this person? You know, what are they good at? What are they not so good at? That's all you want to know. See, Mark, I said I'm not answering it, and then I gave you 4 minutes with Nick. All right, send me an email. I promise I won't destroy everybody on the air. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Want to get in touch? Call or email any day, anytime. 855-411-JILL or ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. Just because you
find yourself. You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger. And if you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. Let's go out and take a call. It's Lauren, who's on the line from Maryland. Hey, Lauren, welcome to the program. What can I do for you?
Good morning, Jill.
Hey.
I've in a conundrum part of my life. Okay. I'm 66.
Okay.
Just barely. And I have some. My husband passed away 2 years ago.
Hmm.
And I've got two kids, one 24, one 25. I've got, you know, after liabilities, mm-hmm. which would be my mortgage, because that's the only assets, only liabilities I've got. I've got like roughly $900,000.
Okay.
All right. Now that breaks out. You know, I've got cash from my husband's life insurance, and my combined total cash can. I got a 401k as well, or a TSP actually,
mm-hmm.
which is a federal
yep.
employee plan. That is, you know, $900,000 after, you know, those combined cash counts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got collectibles, for which I have standing cash offers.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I bought good stuff.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, just, you know, my husband had a comic book collection.
Really?
Yeah, I was amazed. The thing is worth $15,000.
Sold.
I tell you, I was amazed.
Hit that bid, girl.
I tell you.
So, what are you doing with all this money? I mean, are you living off of it, or do
that's
you?
The question.
Okay.
I'm in a 4-bedroom house.
Okay.
Okay, which is way the heck too big for me.
Mm.
And it's costing me about cost of staying in the house per year over the mortgage
mm-hmm.
is about $23,000.
Mm.
So it's costing me an arm and a leg.
Yeah.
All right. And the kids aren't home anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in this 4-bedroom house all by myself, bang, 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 you know.
Yeah.
And I clearly need to get out, get into a smaller house. I'm also disabled, which means that I don't do too well with steps.
Right.
And, you know, I need to get something that's all on one floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, I'm not particular about area. I've looked at a couple of areas here. But, you know, I'm somewhat scared of moving. That's a lot for somebody who's in the position I'm in. I'm ready mm-hmm. right at the moment. I'm on a walker. But still got to get it done.
You know? Right.
And in the meanwhile, I've got all this. Yeah, I've got, you know, cash that's just sitting in the bank doing nothing.
So let me ask you a question. Let me just interject here.
Okay.
So right now, the thrift savings plan, is it still in the thrift savings plan?
It
or
is.
Did you? Okay, I got
it
you.
It is, and it's in my name.
Okay.
As opposed to my husband's name.
And how much money is in the life insurance proceeds?
Okay, the life insurance proceeds that I got from him, mm-hmm. I've got about, I think probably $300,000.
Okay.
$400,000, actually, closer.
And if you were to sell your home and okay. move to something else,
okay.
would it be a kind of a clean swap? Because sometimes what happens is you sell a bigger home, but you want a house that's easy, that's in a good place. Do you think you'd actually cash out any money from that, or do you think it would basically be a trade?
No, it would not be a trade.
You have a little extra money.
Yeah, because my realtor
mm-hmm.
says the house is worth $525,000.
Okay.
And and he's given me a guarantee of 5% realtor commission.
So let me ask you this.
You wanted to know how
yeah.
much I would make. Probably, I think probably, well, let's see. I got mortgage and home equity of, let's see, $346,000.
All right.
And $71,000.
So even if you had like $100,000 out after all was said and done, you get to a new place, you decorate it, you're going to have $1 million. Are you comfortable managing the $1 million yourself, or do you need to work with somebody?
I'm probably going to need to work with somebody, but problem is, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, where in the heck do I find a financial?
That is what I'm about to tell you, girl. I am telling you this right now. First of all, don't move anything out of the thrift savings plan because it's cheap and it works. But you are going to need some help. You've got a lot of things that are going on. I could tell right now. There's just like a lot of There's a like you're spinning plates, you know, you're on the unicycle spinning plates. There's a lot going on. So what I'm going to suggest to you is that you start interviewing financial planners. So a couple of resources for you that I want you to think about. The easiest thing to do immediately is to go onto the Certified Financial Planning Board website. And it's letsmakeaplan.org. Letsmakeaplan.org. And when you get there, immediately, it literally is going to say, find a CFP professional today. And you are going to put in your city, your state, and your zip code. And all of a sudden, a bunch of names are going to pop up. And what you're going to try to do is talk to a couple of them, find out how they charge. Some might say, hey, I just charge an hourly rate, or I just charge a flat rate. Give me for $1 million, I'll do this. And they're going to talk to you about it. The other thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to have Mark send you the 10 questions you must ask a financial advisor before you hire one. We have it on our website. It's fabulous on JillOnMoney.com. So the reason I want you to have that in hand is that it will guide you through your conversation with these folks. And once you have a good relationship with somebody, they'll talk to you about the house, the proceeds, the thrift savings plans, the collectibles, and how to manage what you're going to be looking at as hopefully many years of retirement. So we'll follow up with you, Lauren. Thank you so much for calling. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. And our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Want to get in touch? Call or email any day, anytime. 855-411-JILL or askjill@jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger. You know, I do a lot of writing, and if you want to check that out, you can go to our website, JillOnMoney.com. You can just click on the blogs tab. And what I usually do is I put up the column that I write for the Tribune Company, which some of you may see in your, you know, sending my syndicated column and a bunch of different papers. And at the end of last year, I actually put together a post that was really trying to take a look back at what the legacy of the past administration was and, you know, try to fairly judge it. There, you know, obviously not everybody does everything well and not everybody does everything poorly. So here is an email from Terry who writes, good and fair recap on the Obama economy. I'm curious about your comment under regulation. Unfortunately, the nation's largest financial institutions are still overly leveraged, complicated, and interconnected, which makes them prone to inflict damage on the overall financial system, and they are still too big to fail. Terry writes, and by the way, Terry is part of like the Community Bankers Association of a state. So Terry's like, for real. I could not agree with you more, but how did you personally come to this conclusion? Since there are so many competing arguments out there, especially from the too big to fail banks and their trade groups, as well as the Federal Reserve and the FDIC. Thanks for sharing. So, Mark, make sure you send this show a copy of the show notes to Terry so I don't have to actually respond to this because I'm lazy. So here's what I mean by that. You know, a few weeks ago, President Trump signed an order which essentially said, let's look at all of Dodd-Frank. Let's look at all of the reform that has arisen after the financial crisis. And remember what happened in Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank was supposed to go back in time and say, what happened here? How did we just almost get to the precipice of financial disaster? And what can we do to protect the financial system and the economy at large. And there were a few different parts of it. There were parts where the Federal Reserve said, we're going to actually now be watching the systemically important financial institutions. They're called SIFIs. And some companies were not happy to be labeled as a SIFI, because when you're labeled as a SIFI, it means you've got to keep a whole bunch of extra money on hand. Capital requirements. Why is that? Because when the banks were teetering, what became abundantly clear is they just didn't have enough money on hand to manage it. So think of it this way. It's like you as an individual being over-leveraged. I don't have enough cash on hand. I can't pay my bills. My mortgage balloons up. Everyone's coming and pounding on my door, and I don't have the money. So there was a beefed up regulation around how much capital you have on hand. There was also some changes. There were changes about certain businesses that the Fed said, we really don't think banks should be in anymore. And so, you know, you can't own a gas or a pipeline or certain things and commodities and this, that, and the other thing. So I would say, though, if you're really with a critical eye towards Dodd-Frank, there were some major flaws. And one of the major flaws was not so much that banks, you know, we have to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act, that you can't have a retail bank and investment bank under the same roof. But what became clear to me is in the aftermath, it was not so much about, yes, it was capital, but it was also the leverage, the amount of borrowed money that was available that really made this situation in the financial crisis go haywire. And so what I think would have probably helped in the reform, first of all, it was just too big and too cumbersome and too much left to individual regulatory bodies. And there just needed to be a bigger overhaul than that. But I think in addition to beefed up capital requirements, we could have made rules about leverage. You know, you can't use so much borrowed money. And when you use borrowed money, bad things can happen, as we know as individuals. Not zero borrowed money, but just rules about that. And maybe that we would have had to have more disclosure or more of a central clearing around what businesses you were entangled with. Maybe it had to be a better declaration of the risks that some of your clients were taking. All these things that I think probably would have been better included in Dodd-Frank. And of course, I thought that Dodd-Frank should have mandated that the SEC create a fiduciary standard, as opposed to the Department of Labor picking it up later, that the SEC create a fiduciary standard that would really have consumer protections that people could understand without so much wiggle room, that wasn't so much based on, you know, does this guy charge a commission or not, but what is really in the best interest of the client? What is really the best interest of the client? So I think that the system is sounder, things are better. But I still think that if we had a big bank that had some weird trading issue that cascaded across the system, that of course the government was going to have to, would have to bail it out. And I believe that that's probably still the case, unfortunately. So maybe they'll make it better. We'll have to see. All right, Jill on Money. The phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, or send us an email, askjill at jillonmoney.com. Hey, did you notice earlier this month that Merriam-Webster added 1,000 new words to the dictionary? My favorite, of course, in honor of me and Mark, binge watch. Mark, I've been binge watching The Crown. He finished it already. I'm not done yet. Don't say anything. I love it. There are some words that are funny that I actually am surprised that weren't actually there. I mean, it's interesting. Ginger? That seems odd. What's mumblecore? I don't even know what that is. Ping, like I'm going to ping you. Wayback and Wayback Machine. Let me just see something else that's kind of funny. Familiar words combine to give us metaphors or imagery like train wreck, side eye, and weak sauce. As for verbs, we can ride shotgun, walk back an opinion, throw shade. Throw shade! Mark's not happy about that one. Geek out. No standards, Mark says. That's just it. Snollygoster was dropped from the Collegiate Dictionary in 2003 because it had fallen from use. But its frequent use by conservative pundit Bill O'Reilly sent people to the dictionary to find it. And over in recent years, they said that, oh, maybe we actually should put that back in. It was used in name-calling politics of the 19th century. Snollygoster. Snollygoster. EpiPen. Urgent care. And that's kind of interesting, right? Anyway, I'm waiting to see robo-advisor get added. Hasn't been yet. That should be next. We'll get to that one. All right. A little amble away from the financial world. Okay. You're listening to Jill on Money. That's the end of hour one. Stay tuned. We're going to the interview segment. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back.